Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the future of America's Great Plains, and what should be done with land no longer being cultivated for food? The plains make up nearly 20% of the land area of the continental U.S., and in the 19th century, all that arable land seemed to be the key to economic growth and national prosperity. The first big hit to that dream came during the Dust Bowl, of course, and as my guest today will explain, the exodus has continued for 80 years. Literally thousands of farming towns have disappeared in that time, and more remain at risk, given changes in the way agriculture is done today and the unabating pressures on the underground water supply. Journalist Will S. Hilton wrote the July cover story for Harper's Magazine. It's called Broken Heartland, The Looming Collapse of the Great Plains. Will, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
So you open this story with a couple of academics who for 25 years have been pursuing this dream of returning the plains to their natural state. What does that mean, and how did that idea come about?
Well, so yes, this year is the 25th anniversary of the first time that Deborah and Frank Popper proposed that idea. And the idea emerged on the heels of the history you discussed in the intro. I mean, it's hard to even know how long settlement on the plains has been challenged. We know, for example, that Native American plains tribes were mostly migratory, and that some called it, for example, the place where nobody lives. But it's hard to know whether they learned the lesson that settlement on the plains is difficult in the fickle weather conditions of that region through attempts to settle long before Europeans did. But certainly by the time Europeans really made a concerted effort to settle the plains in the late 1800s and early 1900s, the project has been riddled with challenges, mostly environmental. And so this idea that the Poppers first proposed in 1987 to return the plains, to embrace the decline and allow the plains to slide back into a natural state full of native species, including plants and buffalo, switchgrass, and they called this the Buffalo Commons. This idea was really the first time that the decline of the plains, and I would put the word decline in sort of scare quotes because a lot of environmentalists wouldn't feel at all that it's a decline to return to nature, but the decline of the settlement project on the plains is maybe something that we should embrace, and no one had really been saying that before.
We tend to think of the plains as sort of natural farmland, but in fact, a lot has to be done to get the land ready to go and to allow there to be enough water to irrigate crops.
That's right. I mean, it's interesting if you come, as I do, from the mid-Atlantic with ideas about what constitutes sort of proper farmland, and I come from a farming family on one side with a lot of history in the Virginia mountains and foothills. And so I have a sort of a natural predisposition to look out over a landscape like the plains with these undulating, treeless hills, very subtle hills, and to think, wow, let's get some cattle on here right away. Let's get the combines going. But the truth is that some of the environmental problems we've had on the plains were directly linked to the tilling. So the deep roots of side oats, grama, and some of the native grasses that evolved on the plains are 17 feet deep, and they held the soil together even in these whirling dust bowl-like conditions. We didn't have an actual dust bowl during prior centuries because the plants that were there managed to hold it together. Of course, all agriculture is done with or at least all large-scale commodities agriculture is done with annual crops. I mean, there are exceptions like asparagus, but for the most part, when you have grain crops, they're all annual, and so you have to till, and then you expose the soil to the possibility of massive erosion and also dust storms.
So what's happened to the land that is no longer being actively farmed? Is it just sitting there?
Yeah, a lot of it's gone back into the conservation reserve programs, and so rather than subsidize farmers to produce grain crops, we're helping subsidize them not to produce them, which is kind of an interesting phenomenon, at least theoretically. What ends up happening, though, is that in a lot of sort of patchwork places in the rural counties of the High Plains, you have almost a de facto buffalo common. In other words, there aren't necessarily buffalo, but the native grasses, which have always been the most successful out there, are coming back on their own by wind. And so, you know, in a lot of these areas where water is running low and where, you know, it's increasingly difficult to get a sufficient yield to generate a profit, farmers have actually returned the land to nature already.
So you were invited by the president of the Kansas Farmers Union to spend some time on his family's property. And they're a really interesting case because as a small operation, they converted years ago to organic farming, mostly because they can't afford to go with the conventional style of farming the way it's practiced today.
Yeah, it's fascinating to spend some time. The guy's name is Don Teske, and he's this wonderful figure who seems extraordinarily gruff on the outside. But he's also incredibly sensitive to the complexities of farming on the plains and would by no means, I think, project his own sensibility onto his neighbors. But many of his neighbors do share the idea that the conversion to organic farming is the only sensible way forward. And it's interesting, too, because I just found out yesterday that Teske has been named to the EPA's Farm and Ranch Advisory Board. So. You know, that voice and that perspective are certainly growing. He and I spent a lot of time, smoking cigars and sipping whiskey and looking at cattle, but we also spent a lot of time talking about what the last 40 years of farming history in his region have been like. And 40 years or 50 years is kind of a good starting point because, for him, the real defining feature of this transition has been, the rise of technology. And, you know, by technology, I don't just mean computers or GPS-guided tractors and combines, although those are certainly prevalent, but also other kinds of technology like modified seed and chemical fertilizer and pesticides and herbicides and new ways of irrigation. And his view, and in the view of a lot of his neighbors and friends and family, is that the rise of those technological capabilities has eviscerated the old economic model for farming. In other words, all of these things cost to add into the farming operation. And so while that technology raises yields, commodities prices have not risen terribly quickly over the last 30 or 40 years. And so the rise in yield has not been enough to compensate for the rise in input costs through all of those, you know, the seed, the fertilizer, the pesticide, the herbicide, and so forth. And so what happens is the profit margin per acre has gone down considerably, that means that while it's possible to farm more land, it's also necessary to farm more land in order to turn the same profit or in order to pocket the same amount of cumulative profit through the year. And so farms have to grow, and when a neighbor gets into some trouble, they get bought out by another neighbor who in turn is bought out by another neighbor, and the neighbors who are growing, of course, are required to carry more debt in order to purchase the land as well as the new technology. And so you see the rise of agribusiness being linked to the phenomenon of depopulation. When Teske looks out over the farmland that surrounds his own farm and which used to sustain dozens of families, none of whom are there anymore, you know, he sees the rise in technology as the culprit.
Yeah, it's interesting when you and Teske visited the seed cleaner. The seed cleaner said it used to be that when somebody got into some trouble, there were neighbors they could call on, and we all sort of pulled together, and those neighbors simply aren't there anymore.
Yeah, and, you know, it's kind of incredible just driving around. You go through these towns in Kansas. I mean, there are more than 6,000 ghost towns in Kansas, places where not only did neighbors buy out neighbors rather than help them through, but then they got bought out by someone who's not a neighbor at all, by a company that's far enough away that there's no reason to have anyone occupy the town whatsoever. And it's very striking when you drive through. It doesn't feel, it feels creepy. It doesn't feel like America. It doesn't feel like the ideal of, you know, American growth and prosperity that just so recently was echoed on the plains. I mean, you know, the planes were kind of, they kind of always have been this symbol for America, this enduring symbol of our, the last destiny to manifest. They were the last place to really, that we attempted large-scale settlement. And so to see that in such abject failure in these rural towns is really striking. And yet the agriculture, for now anyway, continues. I mean, it's a phenomenon that's kind of like what we see in manufacturing. You know, a lot of people believe that the U.S. manufacturing base is gone, and by some metrics, of course, it is. But in fact, you know, total output is as high as it's ever been for U.S. manufacturing, and we're still, by almost every measure, either first or second manufacturing power in the world. So what's really gone and what's felt so acutely in so many regions like the Rust Belt is the need for labor. So, mm-hmm. so these manufacturing facilities are able to maintain the same output without very many people to run them. And in the same way, agriculture on the plains for now is bustling along and producing a greater yield every year, but it just doesn't take many people.
Is it a reasonable question to ask whether, I mean, setting aside the very major and significant point of the families who are suffering because they are losing their livelihoods with the conversion to more corporate agriculture, I mean, is corporate agriculture worse overall for consumers, for the general population?
I mean, it's such a complicated question, and it's one that has to be sort of grappled with, I think, by each person bringing into force the variables that they consider most urgent. It's certainly the case that by tapping into the aquifer, the Ogallala Aquifer, which underlies so much of the High Plains and which was mostly untouched until about the end of World War II, by tapping into that, we've seen a rise in agricultural production that's almost hard to believe when you look at the numbers or you look at the graph. The rise is exponential. I mean, it's staggering, and so that provides, that keeps people alive, and it feeds the hungry. It makes it possible for us to export food and to generate income, which sustains our family and our civilization in other ways. So certainly there's a lot to be said for the rise in agricultural productivity that's come from settlement on the plains originally and now the continuation of corporate agriculture on the plains and even the tapping of the aquifer. But in order to counterbalance that with other views, it was really important to me to kind of wander around the plains, as it were, and hear a lot of voices. I mean, I feel like when you're looking at an expanse that's so big, it's good to kind of keep in mind both the overarching reality that this region has a lot of coherence, that for the aquifer is one good example, but the kinds of weather that strike it and the kinds of grasses that grow and the short grass prairie and all of these things kind of keep the plains as a unit and as a symbol, certainly, you know, the plains are what we mean by the heartland or the frontier, and we think of the plains as a high plains as a unit, but there's also this incredibly diverse set of specific and local or regional problems and ideas that are distinct. For example, in Nebraska, there's a very different relationship to the aquifer. It's the same aquifer, but it replenishes faster. And so I wanted to try to make sure that I was hearing both the views of corporate agriculture and then also farmers like Teske and then folks in the wind community and the water community. And I'm not sure that there is exactly a consensus on very many things related to corporate agriculture right now.
Will S. Hilton is my guest. His cover story in Harper's is called Broken Heartland, The Looming Collapse of the Great Plains. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Will S. Hilton. His July cover story in Harper's Magazine is called Broken Heartland, The Looming Collapse of the Great Plains. If you'd like to join us, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Well, in addition to explaining and exploring what's going on with human beings, this piece really is a great explanation of the geology of the Oglala Aquifer. It is, as you mentioned earlier, absolutely massive. It reaches into 8 states. How did it form?
Well, about 10 million years ago, it started to get filled in. The landscape in that area started to get filled in with erosion sediment from the Rockies. And there are enough gaps and cracks in the sediment that it can hold water. And so like any water table or aquifer, the water's not just a big pond underground. It's saturated soil or saturated sand is probably a more accurate description. Mm-hmm. And there's an awful lot of it. As you said, it's so big that it reaches under 8 states. I mean, I live in the Mid-Atlantic near the Chesapeake Bay, which is, you know, a huge body of water that everybody's aware of. You're not too far from the Gulf of Mexico. Of course, you can't see the Ogallala because it's underground, and so we don't often think about what a major part of our geology it is. But if you could bring it up to the surface, it would actually be 5 times larger than any freshwater lake in the world. So when we think about the impact of depleting that supply, it's a pretty substantial part of what we have been depending upon for life in this country, at least since the Second World War when we started tapping into it.
And you mentioned that the situation as to how it is recharged is different in the state of Nebraska than in the 7 other states that are affected by it. Talk about that and talk about why it doesn't recharge easily.
Well, it's just the area, the soil above the aquifer, because the aquifer is, of course, the bottom's not flat and there are all sorts of different geologic deposits within the vast expanse of the aquifer basin, but for the most part, the surface, the land surface above the aquifer sheds water rather than percolating it through to refill. So we might imagine or hope that for every gallon we pump out of the aquifer, another gallon of rainfall or more would replenish that. And that is how it works in a lot of water tables, but it's not how it works at the Ogallala. So, for example, I went and visited with Kevin Mulligan, who's a geologist at Texas Tech and is helping to run a USDA program that measures the drawdown of the aquifer and how much exactly we're taking and how much exactly is left. And we spent a day looking at maps and charts that he's put together over 20 years. And it was pretty grim. I mean, a lot of these areas are, in fact, already dry, and other areas are drying up pretty fast. And, you know, that's different in Nebraska, as you mentioned, but for most of the Great Plains, it is the case that, as Mulligan explained it to me, in 20 or 30 years, there's just not going to be enough water left in the aquifer to sustain irrigated agriculture. Now, right now, and for the last 40 years or 50 years, the Ogallala has supported about a third of the groundwater irrigation for the United States. Hmm. So that's a pretty big supply of water to just suddenly disappear.
And there's no reason to think that hyper-efficient corporate farms won't be affected by this in the same way that smaller farms are?
Right. So there are, it's possible that some clever scientist, perhaps at Monsanto, will come up with a grain that's sufficiently drought-tolerant that it can survive with dryland farming and produce the same yields even in marginal land. But that would be a great feat of engineering and would come, of course, with its own questions about GM grain. For now, there are a lot of areas that are currently being farmed which would not be sustainable without the irrigation. Hmm. And so, you know, Mulligan said, for example, that it's not the right way to think about the Ogallala is not as a reservoir in the sense that you take a little and there's a sustainable level of use, and as long as you don't exceed that, it'll continue to support you. He said it's better to think of it like a seam of gold. You can take a little this year and a little next year, or you can take it all at once, but when it runs out, it's gone forever. And interestingly, he was not terribly concerned about that as a resident of the High Plains and as a geologist who knows perhaps more about it than anyone else. But his view was, hey, it's been down there for 10 million years, and it's a resource that can help support human life and civilization. And it's offered no real benefit to human or animal life in the past. It's too far down. It doesn't interact with the surface ecosystem. And so if it's gone all of a sudden, in a way, that's just a return to normal. But in the meantime, a lot of people will have been able to support their families with cheap food. That's, of course, just one view, but it's interesting that he was much more concerned, for example, about the rise of wind power mm-hmm. on the plains than about the diminishment of the Ogallala.
We'll talk about that in a moment, but I do want to ask, I mean, should we assume that food prices will be exponentially higher once the Ogallala is gone?
Well, it's possible that we'll just begin importing a lot more foods. And it's also, a lot of things are possible. But it certainly is a source of food, really, that is going to disappear if Kevin Mulligan is right. And one would assume that absent some change in the technology to produce that food, that would raise prices, yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Bert in Dallas. Hi, Bert.
Hi. We have a family farm up near Amarillo, and it strikes me as how dependent we are on the government for their, you know, for their crop subsidies, and much of the farm was profitable because of the CRP, which was paid pretty good money just to put it to grass, and you had to keep it there for so many years.
Excuse me, Bert. But what is CRP?
The crop reserve program.
Okay.
I'm sorry. He mentioned that, and what it does, what you just don't. You put it into grass, you can't graze it, and you just take it off the market mm-hmm. for a period of years. But those programs are ending, and much of it is coming out now, and our only option is to put it back into either dry land wheat, or we've drilled a couple more wells. But we're always crossing our fingers and hoping that we can hit the water at the right depth and the wells keep flowing. But the curious thing to me is when it comes out of CRP, you've got this grass that has not survived the drought, and it just strikes me as how difficult it is to reestablish that land into any kind of, viable native land that really, you know, that in any way approaches what we had before we put it to plow. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Thanks for your call.
Yeah, you know, it's a really interesting point, and it raises this sort of overarching confluence of challenges that I think farmers face all up and down the Great Plains. I mean, the particularities of how different state programs implement conservation efforts can be different, but overall, I think it seems to be the case that farmers everywhere on the High Plains are dealing not only with the whims of weather, but also the whims of policy. And as these policies change over time, the farmer's hand is forced. So there are farmers who are farming crops they don't particularly want to farm, but the subsidies are workable there in that crop for their region. And the crop they would rather farm for any number of reasons is not viable because the subsidies aren't there and the commodities prices won't support it alone. But there's also this pressure on farmers in some cases through similar subsidies to put land back into the Conservation Reserve Program. And the fear that some farmers have is if we do that and then we need to and the subsidies change or the incentives change, and then we need to farm this land again, or if that magic seed comes from Monsanto and everybody wants to eat that crop so that we can support farming on this land again, is it going to be possible to get the land back into farming, or how many years will it take before we can get it back into farming after it's been, you know, gone to seed, as it were?
So, Will, you mentioned earlier that this geologist at Texas Tech, Kevin Mulligan, has particular concerns about the rise of the wind farming industry in the Great Plains. For a long time, we've been told that traditional agriculture or modern agriculture and wind turbines can peacefully coexist. What's the reality of that?
Well, it's definitely possible. It seems that in a lot of places where there are ranches and farmers are grazing, they should be able to continue to do so after the turbines come in. But it also seems to be the case that in a lot of places the farmers or the ranchers do stop grazing. And then in places where there's a lot of farming going on, and I should probably distinguish in case listeners don't know, where I come from, farming, you can farm cattle, but on the High Plains you can't farm cattle. You farm crops and you ranch and you graze cattle. And so these terms are a little different than what a lot of us might be used to, but if you're grazing cattle and you get turbines, you should be able to continue grazing cattle. If you're farming cropland, you might be able to continue, but a lot of the farmers who are farming crops say, well, we're not going to keep doing that after the turbines come. We're going to switch to cattle. And then the question is, will they in fact switch to cattle, or will they do like the actual cattle ranchers do and basically just go to wind? So that's one of the questions about wind is, you know, the farmers and ranchers who are bringing it in see it in a lot of respects as a supplement to the diminishing Ogallala. In other words, as their irrigation runs out, they'll need another source to supplement the loss of income, and the wind should be a way to supplement it. But if that means that the farming and ranching will simply stop, then we have an even more extreme diminishment of the resource. The other thing about wind, and the thing that Kevin Mulligan, the guy who knows all about the Ogallala, talked about, and he spoke about this not as a scientist but as a resident, is that when you go to these places where, you know, like Roscoe, Texas, near Sweetwater, where the biggest wind farm in the world is, and you drive around and you're surrounded by turbines as far as the eye can see, it's not as pretty as the rest of the plains. It looks different. It doesn't look like the plains anymore. It looks like an industrial facility. So we may decide that that's a worthwhile sacrifice in order to have this renewable source of energy. But there is a cost associated with it that a lot of people living in those areas are trying to value. How much diminishment of the landscape is it worth to generate the income?
Meanwhile, energy developers are racing to snap up rights to this land that they can put their turbines on, and Texas turns out to be particularly appealing to them, in part because we don't have the kind of regulations that other states have.
That's right, yeah. And some of this is just technology, too. I mean, until recently, most of the wind farms on the plains were in central and lower Texas. And I guess this is another place where terminology gets a little tricky because you all are in North Texas, but the part of Texas that's really furthest north calls itself West Texas, and so I don't want to mix up my phrasing. But
you're talking about the Panhandle region.
Yeah, right? So the Panhandle is not part of ERCOT, which is the Texas grid. There are three grids, electrical grids in the U.S. that can receive wind power or any other power-generating source. There's the Eastern, the Western, and then there's the Texas grid. And so the Texas grid is a very appealing place to put a wind farm because there are a lot of cities within a relatively confined area compared to the rest of the plains. So Dallas, Houston, Fort Worth, Austin, all these cities can be reached by a wind farm in Sweetwater or Nolan County. If you're up on the Panhandle, which is outside still Texas, but it's outside the Texas grid, it's part of the Eastern grid, if you put a wind farm up there, all of a sudden you got to send your wind a lot further away. So there are new transmission lines that have been going in to link the Panhandle with the Texas grid. And there's also a new three-grid connector going into Clovis, New Mexico, which will allow all three grids to exchange power more efficiently. And as that happens, it opens up the potential market for wind farms everywhere else on the Great Plains.
How much money can a property owner receive for having a wind turbine on his or her land?
Well, so different people I spoke with gave me different numbers, and partly that's because there's different technology. One of the people I quoted in the story was Mulligan, who, in his concern about the cost, visually brought up the cost economically or the value economically as well. And he was saying that a farmer could get about $5,000 per turbine
annually.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to RJ in Carrollton. Hi, RJ.
Hi. I have a question about the impact of the hydrocarbon fracking industry on the prairie lands or the central part of the United States. For example, I've been doing some reading and just gathering some information. For each new shale well, it takes 4 million to 8 million gallons of water. And that water can never be reprocessed and put back into the land or the aquifer or whatever.
We're going to take a quick break, RJ, but we can get a response. It's not something that comes up in the piece, but we'll find out if Will has some information for us.
My
guest this hour is journalist Will S. Hilton of Harper's Magazine. He wrote the cover story for the July issue, and it's called Broken Heartland, The Looming Collapse of the Great Plains. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, we welcome your input and your questions at 1-800-933-5372. And, of course, as always, you can write to us at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Journalist Will Hilton is with us. Will S. Hilton. He wrote the cover story for the July issue of Harper's. It's called Broken Heartland, The Looming Collapse of the Great Plains. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or via email to think@kera.org. And Will, you recall before the break we had a telephone call from RJ asking about, through the process of hydraulic fracturing to recover natural gas, a rather large quantity of water is contaminated and then cannot be used for agriculture. Did this come up even as a sideline as you were sort of investigating this whole process?
It did. There are a couple ways in which the natural gas hunt has the potential to really affect the plains. In terms of the deposits on the plains, what's kind of interesting is that there are certainly some, and there are especially some in the north. But overall, if you pull up a map with the major natural gas deposits, they form this kind of ring around the core of the High Plains, which in fact provides a new incentive for the migratory exodus. In other words, there are a lot of jobs in these towns, and as the jobs and the future dry up on the High Plains, the incentive for the second or third generation to move somewhere else for natural gas recovery it's just one of many reasons to continue the depopulation trend. As far as the impact on something like the Ogallala, to the extent that there will be a Ogallala in the future, the fear is that that this Keystone Pipeline that's going to come from the northern deposits and would cross the High Plains could potentially leak and seep into the aquifer. That would, of course, be catastrophic.
So there are different approaches to what ought to be done as the plains, the conditions on the plains change, the water levels change. Tell us about Alan Savory and his ideas for what was called holistic, or is called holistic management.
Yeah, so Alan Savory's ideas are embodied in a very small number of ranchers who are grazing with a technique that Savory kind of perfected. Savory was this character who in the 50s and 60s in what was then Rhodesia, developed a whole series of changes to the way that livestock management is performed. And at the core of the changes was this idea of rotation grazing, which is much more understood now than it was then. But the principle of rotation grazing, for Savory anyway, was that that it preserves the impact of the native species. In other words, cattle on grassland behave very differently than buffalo do. Buffalo have a tendency to wander around further distances and eat just about everything, and what little they don't eat, they tear up pretty bad with their hoof action. Cattle are much more likely to stay within a certain radius of a water source. They're a little pickier about what they'll eat. And because there are large areas on a large ranch where they're not even traveling, their hoof action in some whole swaths of the ranch has no impact at all. And so what you get, what a lot of ranchers deal with, is that they have this old morbid grass in places where the cattle don't go, and then they have this grass that's been just trampled to death in places where they do go. So the whole ranch can be a combination of areas that are overgrazed and areas that are overgrown with very little balance in between the two. And so Savory's idea is, instead of just having this big fence around the perimeter or a few fence lines to separate large paddocks, let's make a bunch of small ones, in some cases like 100, and rotate the cattle every few days. And then they'll have to eat everything before they're allowed to move on. And then that area won't be grazed again for a long time, so it'll have a chance to recover. And I went out to a ranch. I actually went out there for a different reason, to try to figure out why this old-timer out in western Kansas refused to kill his prairie dog. And it ended up being more of an education in how rotation grazing through the Savory method really looks, because it turned out that his insistence on preserving the prairie dogs was part of the holistic management philosophy that he had learned by studying Savory.
His neighbors can't stand him because the prairie dogs don't stay on his property alone.
Right. It's hard to stop the prairie dogs from tunneling wherever they want. He actually has tried. This guy Larry Haverfield has tried to control the spread of them through elaborate fencing, and for the most part, it seems that he was able to keep them from bleeding onto his neighbor's properties. But especially in the first decade or so of this management style that he was using, you know, he had the prairie dog population on his land ballooning, and his neighbors saw that, and they just freaked out. I mean, it seemed certain that he was going to cause the end of ranching in his area. The prairie dog is, not beloved among ranchers, and he had at the high point about 6,000 acres of his 10,000 acre ranch were Dogtown. So that's something to behold for sure. His efforts to preserve the prairie dogs were supported by groups like Audubon of Kansas and Nature Conservancy and groups like that, and so he was able through remedy at the court and things like that to maintain this policy long enough that the fruits began to show. And by fruits, I mean the predators came back. Once he allowed the prairie dogs to stick around for a while, a lot of the native predators, like the ferruginous hawk and the black-footed ferret, they started to boom on his property as well. And now when I was out there, we hardly saw any prairie dogs. You could still see evidence of the dog towns, but the prairie dogs were getting picked pretty clean.
We have an email here from Kelly in Dallas who writes, what about implementing the Poppers Commons and developing massive wind harvesting, the massive wind harvesting region? Might be some legitimate concerns about the effect on birds, but I doubt the bison would mind and drawdowns of the aquifer would cease. As for the loss of agricultural crops, most of the so-called food grown in the Midwest is used for animal forage, industrial food additives, and ethanol production, all of which I'd be willing to give up. What do you think about all that?
I think that it raises a very interesting point, which is one that Frank Popper especially has begun to embrace, and that is that the idea first articulated by the Poppers in their proposal for the Buffalo Commons 25 years ago may not be the gospel forever. Their original vision was that there should be a national park, highly regulated, deprivatized. And they're now much more willing, especially Frank. The Poppers disagree on a lot of stuff, and it's kind of adorable to watch them debate the details of it. But Frank especially is more willing to imagine a version of the Buffalo Commons in which various kinds of industry or agriculture could be part of it. I went with the Poppers one night to visit a guy named Wes Jackson, who has a little spot called the Land Institute in central Kansas. Jackson proposes a kind of agriculture that could be consistent with a Buffalo Commons.
And what does Deborah object to in all that?
Well, I think Deborah is still not convinced that it's likely. I think that, I don't know that she objects in principle to a private version of the Buffalo Commons. For example, if Ted Turner bought the rest of the Great Plains, and he seems to be trying to, I don't know that she would have any problem with it being done privately, and then harvesting some of the buffalo for Ted's Montana Grill or whatever it's called, a tasty hamburger, by the way. but I think that in her view, it's unlikely to unfold that way. So there's always been this kind of fine line between the prescriptivist and the descriptivist versions of their proposal. And on the one hand, the Buffalo Commons is something that they think is inevitable, and so they're trying to describe what it will look like. On the other hand, they also believe that it's a good idea, and they're trying to define how it should unfold. And oftentimes, I think, that's where the sort of core difference of opinion emerges between the two Poppers.
What about people like Don Teske? I mean, is he sort of fatalistic about all this? Does he hope and expect that his grandchildren will end up farmers?
I think he is preparing for the wind. Mm-hmm. His son's studying wind technology at college. And, if you push him enough, he'll acknowledge that is probably where it's going to end up. But I think he's much more attracted to a terrestrial future in which something can be done to increase the number of organic small farms. And, of course, for him, organic is almost a funny term because he sees himself as really just doing things the old-fashioned way, and now everybody calls that organic.
Mm-hmm.
And he would like to try to see a future in which that can happen, but he's prepared to accept that that when he looks out across the surrounding fields, that's not what's happening.
Do you think, Will, that the coexistence between organic farming operations, we shouldn't assume that all organic farming operations are very small, but smaller organic family-run operations and larger corporate operations, will that continue, will the balance continue to shift toward corporate farming?
It certainly seems that way for now.
Yeah.
The big unspoken variable there is whether the crops themselves can change, and if whether Monsanto comes up with a magic seed that doesn't require any pesticide, herbicide, irrigation water, or anything else.
That literally is magic.
That would be magic. Yeah. On the other hand, Wes Jackson in Kansas has come up with a perennialized grain crop, which I've tasted, and it's pretty good. I mean, it's not noticeably different from regular flour, which may be the best thing about it. if you want to convince people to buy something different, it helps if it's just like what they already like. And this perennialized grain crop would change almost everything about the demands of cropland, because, you know, as soon as the plant has the same root structure as a switchgrass, it has a lot less need for irrigation and fertilizer. It's already got the root structure to get into the nutrients and water much deeper down. And at the same time, it's steeled up against the threat of insects in a way that a tender little annual shoot is not.
How is a perennial grain product harvested? Do you sort of cut it back to the roots and then it comes up the next season?
Yeah, and it can be managed like prairie land, so that you can have some years where you just clip the seed heads, but then other years where you might burn it, or you could have, instead of burning it, you could cut it to the ground. That would help with sunlight penetration. Of course, if you have tall stalks of grain crop and just the seed heads are clipped off, there's still a lot of shadow for next year's to block against the sunlight penetration for growth of next year's crops. So it can be helpful to cut the seed heads off, wait a while, and then cut the rest off, or at least every couple of years to do so. So there would be certainly some change in management policy. Wes Jackson's idea is also one of what he calls polyculture. A lot of the challenges that agriculture faces are also related to monoculture in general, that one thing is grown over a large area. So when you get any kind of invasive bug, it's hard to get rid of them. But if you have a diverse crop, then there are other bugs that will eat the bad bugs.
Are you willing to speculate on what the Great Plains will look like, say, half a century from now?
I'm not. I may have been willing to at the outset of this project.
Yeah.
But the only thing I really learned for sure is that there are a lot of really smart, interesting people who are thinking about this, that there has to be some change. But whose ideas are going to prove to bear fruit, as it were, it's impossible to say.
Do most of those smart people embrace the debate and like the idea that there are lots of ideas floating around?
Much more so than there used to be.
Mm-hmm.
I think it used to be that when Frank and Deborah Popper showed up in town and started talking about the possibility of radical change, even separate from the question of the Buffalo Commons itself, when they just started saying things are going to have to change at the very beginning of their lectures, indeed even before they got there, there were death threats. There were people shouting them down. And now when you go to one of their speeches, everybody's pretty quiet, and people want to have a dialogue about how they're going to get through it.
Journalist Will S. Hilton wrote the cover story for the July issue of Harper's Magazine. It's called Broken Heartland, The Looming Collapse of the Great Plains. Will, it's been a very interesting hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer, and this hour he answered the phones. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast every day. It's free at kera.org/think. If you've got comments, questions, or suggestions, email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.